This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll hear Terry's interview with author Jacqueline Woodson. She won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature last month for her memoir in verse called Brown Girl Dreaming. But let's begin by listening to Terry's conversation with Chris Rock. Rock wrote, directed, and stars in the new movie comedy Top Five. It features several comics and comic actors, including Cedric the Entertainer, Kevin Hart, Tracy Morgan, Michael Che, Jay Farrow, and Jerry Seinfeld. Rock plays Andre Allen, a stand-up comic who has starred in a series of broad comedies as a character called Hammy the Bear, which required wearing a ludicrous bear costume. Andre Allen has given up that role, given up comedy, given up drinking, and is trying to reshape his career with his new dramatic film about a Haitian slave rebellion. Top Five takes place during the day that film opens, as he's winding up his promotional tour. Rosario Dawson plays a New York Times reporter who interviews him and shadows him through the day, a day in which a lot of his assumptions about himself are challenged. In this scene, Andre Allen is promoting his movie on a Sirius satellite radio show, where he's been asked to record a promo.
This is Andre Allen, and when I listen to satellite radio, I listen to Sirius Hits 1.
Just put a little stank on it.
Stank.
Stank. Stank.
Stank?
Give it stank.
Okay, I don't really know what you mean. Could you show me?
You're the funny. All right, it's like, hey! This is Andre Allen, and when I listen to satellite radio, whoa, I listen to Sirius Hits 1. Woo!
Stank.
Stank.
Nice and funny. Go.
What's up?
Chris Rock, welcome back to Fresh Air. Can we just start by acknowledging that it's just a little bit awkward for me to do the interview when a lot of the movie is about how awful it is for a filmmaker to do all the interviews publicizing a movie when the movie's opening?
It's horrible sometimes when your movie's not good because you're, like, defending the movie for the most part. You're trying to stop a plane from crashing. So that's kind of what the movie deals with a little bit more than this.
Have you been in
unless
that position?
You hate the movie, then I'm
no
then I'm in trouble.
Have you been in that position of having to go on a tour promoting something you didn't really like very much?
Oh yeah, a couple of times, a few too many times. You know, not that you didn't like a movie, but just a movie you know the critics don't like. You know, when the critics don't like it, you know, a lot of times they try to change the subject. It's like, this weather is something. How about those Mets? It's like.
So the movie is about somebody who's lost his way, both as a comedian and also as a person. And I'm wondering if you went through a period like that yourself that you drew on in making the movie.
I mean, you know, in any artist, have I lost my way? It's not even that you've lost your way, you just question it. If you've been doing it long enough, you're like, okay, how much longer can I do this? Am I still funny? I feel that would stand up a lot, where I'm like, can I still do it? I mean, I did SNL a few weeks ago. I hadn't done stand-up in a while. Just like, okay, can I pull this off? So, you know, there's natural doubts if you're trying anything. If you're not trying anything, then there's no doubt because you're like a robot.
That was really funny. And I couldn't tell what direction you were heading in at first on Saturday Night Live, you know, honestly. But it got so funny and so good. But, you know, in the movie, the character has actually given up stand-up, and he thinks he doesn't want to be funny anymore. He doesn't feel funny anymore. And he wants to make uplifting entertainment.
Very Stardust Memories, yes.
So
Sullivan's Travels, Stardust Memories.
Right. So when you feel like in those periods where, like you said now, you're sometimes not sure if you want to keep doing stand-up or if you're – is it that you're not sure if you're still funny or that you're not sure you still enjoy doing stand-up or you're not sure that you still have stuff you want to talk about in a stand-up context?
all of the above. I mean, the first fear is, can you do it? And the second fear is, can you do it at the level you did it at as a younger person? Because, you know, even though we're not athletes, you know, we even talk slower than we did whatever years ago. You ever hear, like, when Stern is playing some old show? It's like, wow, his voice is so different than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times, yeah, even though, you know, we're not, you know, we don't lose our knees or anything, but, you know, we change. And it's like, do people even like you anymore is a big thing. It's like, I don't look the way I looked 20 years ago or whatever. Is it going to be same reaction? Do people like somebody? Oh, this new guy's big. Everybody's into his style. It's all doubts.
I want to talk about the character that Cedric the Entertainer plays, Jazzy D. He's really funny in this. Would you describe the character and what he's wearing?
Okay, what he's wearing?
And the great wig. The great wig.
Well, you know, it's not supposed to be a wig, but
supposed to be a wig, yeah.
he's a small-time concert promoter in Houston, Texas. And I'm sure he's got on alligator shoes and some kind of polyester pant and a silk shirt.
Big medallion around his neck.
Big medallion and a bowler hat.
And a kind of not quite James Brown hairdo.
Yes, very James Brown. Got a conch. And he's just one of these promoters. I can get you anything in town. He's that guy. Whatever you need, smoke, weed, girls, whatever you need. I'm the man in Houston. You let me know and I'll get you. And any entertainer, anybody that's toured knows you meet a person like that in pretty much every town you go to.
Okay, and your character says he expects to get off the plane and be met by a college student. And instead, yeah. You know, he's going to drive him to the hotel. And instead, it's this guy. It's Jazzy D. And so those guys who you've met probably particularly earlier in your career when you were less famous.
Yes, particularly. I'm sure you get
a nice limo now.
But, yeah.
But back then, earlier in your career, what are some of these things these guys would actually do for you? And did they also con you?
They would try to get you drugs or women or drugs and women or try to get you to go to their friend's restaurant to take pictures or whatever or, you know, and they would con you and they wouldn't pay you half the time. Sometimes, I remember a lot of times, the promoter would be a bad comedian and put himself on the show. So you had to deal with this guy. And sometimes the guy would not only be a bad comedian, he wouldn't even put himself on the show as to close the show. So
he'd be stupid enough to follow you?
Yeah. Well, you know, it wasn't always like this hard thing to follow me. But a couple of guys, yeah. I remember promoters basically shows with me, Cedric the Entertainer, and Jamie Foxx, and some promoters closing the show.
So another thing in the movie is sobriety is an issue for the character. One of the reasons why he's making serious films is because, like, he's not drinking anymore. And I'm wondering if you've watched a lot of people you know really change as performers and as people when they've stopped drinking or stopped doing drugs.
Oh, yeah. You know, it's weird. The hardest one is stop smoking cigarettes. People stop drinking or stop doing drugs, they basically become better, more truthful people. People stop smoking cigarettes, they actually become worse. It's like people that smoke and quit, ooh, there's some grouchy people. But
yeah, well, because it's not like you're getting high on cigarettes, but the withdrawal is still really bad.
Yeah, the withdrawal is really, really bad. Worse than anything I've ever seen. Totally different people off cigarettes. But yeah, my older brother, you know, pretty much drank himself to death. And, you know, this has been, you know, drinking's been big in my life, even my artistic life. I mean, I did the play, The Mother with the Hat. You know, we were alcoholics in that play. Years ago, I mean, I wasn't drinking, but New Jack City, I play a crackhead. Mm-hmm. So substance abuse has been good to me artistically.
What about in real life? Has it ever been a problem?
It's never been a problem in real life. I just had enough people in my life with problems. And I realized early on working in comedy clubs, it's like I work in a bar. So I probably need to not drink a lot. Because a lot of comedians are alcoholics. A lot of comedians are alcoholics. A lot of comedians are drug addicts. A lot of comedians addicted to gambling. Like, comedians, you know, can be a sad bunch.
So I'm really enjoying talking with you. And here's a question about the movie. And this is the part of the interview where I'm afraid I'm going to lose
Terry
you.
Terry Gross. Come on.
I don't want to give away too much, but there is a woman in a relationship with a guy she doesn't realize is gay, even though the thing he likes best is anal stimulation.
And which doesn't make you gay, by
which doesn't make you gay. And I'm trying to keep this all radio friendly. So there's a few graphic jokes that I can't describe on the radio. One that ends up being kind of cruel, even though it's played for comedy. And let me explain what made me uncomfortable. There's still so many people who think that gay male sex is icky or disgusting. And I'm afraid that this is possibly a way of mocking gay sex without it being gay sex, because it's a woman who's doing the stimulation.
Right.
I thought this had the potential of playing into that pre-existing phobia and having people laugh on a different level. You know what I mean? On a level of like, oh, ick, that's really disgusting, and gay men do that too.
I'm going to say about 4 or 5 women told me similar stories.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, that's how jokes happen. It's never like one person or two. It's like you got to hear it a few times when you do stuff like that, or else, you know, you're just being mean. So I'd heard stories about stuff like this, and I don't know. That's all I got. I don't think about I feel your pain, but I've never thought about any joke or anything like that deeply.
Do you think I'm overreacting?
I mean, you're Terry Gross, so you're, I mean, it's your job to analyze this and, you know, fight the good fight and, you know. But, you know, it's I might be the only black comedian in the country that hasn't gay bashed ever.
Well, that's the thing. I know, but that's the thing. I admire you for not
I'm
doing
like,
that.
Like ever. Like ever.
People are so used to gay bashing jokes in comedy. It's such a common thing. I think that's why.
It's not a common thing.
Gay bashing in comedy?
It's name 2 comedians that do it right now.
Oh, I've heard so many jokes.
Give me 2.
Oh, I'm not good at remembering things.
If somebody asks you to, you say something happens all the time. And then somebody says, give me 2. They didn't say give me 10.
No, well,
they said give you 2.
I will refer you
You're probably wrong, right?
Well, I will refer you to an episode of Louis C.K.'s show. There's a whole riff on that because all the comics are sitting around having their card game.
Yeah, but they're sitting with Rick Crome, this guy we've known for 30 years. He's one of our best friends.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the premise is that people do this in their act, too. And
I mean, I don't know. No one's bashing. Louis C.K. is not.
No, of course not. He was raising the question about where is the line? Like that whole scene was about like, where is the line between something being funny and something being, you know, bashing or stereotypical? But anyways,
I mean, the line, I don't know where the line is. The line, first of all, the line is like religion. Where's the intent? It's like in most religions, you're taught that you're not going to be judged by your actions. You're going to be judged by your intent. So if your intent is to gay bash, yes, you are a gay basher, even when you don't do it. And if your intent is to not, then it's not. Now, it can still be offensive, but once you explain that to the person that made the mistake, you can pretty much be sure they will go back on that and try to rectify hurting you. Does this make sense?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see stuff that I think's a little racist, but I judge the person. I judge their other work. You know, okay, that guy, he just doesn't know. Maybe I'll say something next time I see him. But I don't go to bash, or I don't go to, ooh, he's racist.
Yeah, and I really love your work, and it's not like, you know, I was just wondering about that scene, because there was something about it that was troubling me. So I just thought I'd tell you what it was and that we could talk about it a little. So thank you for talking with me about it. And now I want to tell you something that might seem the opposite of something of that of what I was just saying, which is, you know, I was reading your interview with Frank Rich.
Frank, nice guy.
It's an interview that's gotten a lot of attention. And one of the things you said there was that you don't play college campuses anymore because they've become way too conservative.
And really conservative.
Yeah.
But here's the weird thing. You take those same people off the campus, and they act like adults. This is something weird and very politically correct about. But, I mean, people are sensitive. I mean, you're sensitive.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like, I kind of get exactly what you're saying about people being too PC and how it's really hard to do comedy in that kind of atmosphere where everything you say is going to offend somebody. So I feel a little hypocritical. Totally agreeing with you on that.
I literally just went through it with you.
I know, and then I literally just put you through that. So I just want to make you, like, let you know I'm aware of that contradiction. but sometimes something strikes you the wrong way, so you say something. But, you know, on the other hand, like, I get what you're saying. Can you give us an example? Something you feel like you can't say now.
You just did it. You saw a joke, a guy that's never gay bashed anybody ever.
Right.
In his life. Ever. Ever. Totally opposite. And you got, you know, you kind of got bent out of shape a little bit over the thing. I mean, that's what it is, you know. And it's not even that you got bent out of shape about it. I'm not mad about any of it. No comedian wants to have to analyze and defend something. It's like you thought something was funny, you wrote it down, you acted it out, you talked to people. You know, it works or it doesn't work. I'm not a politician. I'm not a thinker. I'm a comedian. Just like, okay, tell jokes. Some work, some don't. There's no bigger indictment that the joke's not working than to not laugh. Nothing's a bigger indictment. Nothing's a bigger screamingly, this is wrong, than to the sound of non-laughter.
Since you're not doing college campuses anymore, do you miss that? Do you miss that audience? Or is it just like you won't perform on the campus, but you'll perform to those people in
yeah, I'll
like
play
a concert hall.
Campus.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm older now. I mean, my comedy, if you pay bills, taxes, and been in love and lost love and been in relationships, I'm the person for you. College kids are, you know, something else. I like grown people. I like people that have had life punched them in the face.
When you were young, did you think that you would feel that way, or did you always want to be young? You know, it's like,
no,
stay young.
I always hung around older guys. Everybody around me was always 5, 10 years even older than me. And even now, I gravitate to people that are older than me. It's just more interesting, especially comedians. I mean, there's no great 20-year-old comedians. Never been. There's no Justin Bieber of comedy. It just doesn't happen. You know? Eddie Murphy's the only one I ever saw, like, that was really amazing in his 20s. But everybody else, Pryor, everybody, no, most of them didn't get good until they were in their mid-30s.
So I know that you tweeted about the Eric Garner grand jury decision to not indict the police officer who strangled Garner to death. I'm wondering how you feel when an event like that happens, what you feel your desire, your responsibility is to speak about it publicly, you know, in a tweet or...
I mean, I only have a... I'm just tweeting like everybody else. I'm not sitting around thinking I have a response. I'm not Batman. I don't have, like, a responsibility, I don't think. You know, I'll answer a question about it, but to think I have a responsibility is almost... It's very egotistical to think. I mean, the president has a responsibility, and every politician has a responsibility. I mean, I guess I have a responsibility to be aware of it, even though it's not funny at all. There's probably going to be some angle, you know, and I haven't figured it out yet, but there'll be some angle that highlights the injustice that happened.
Can you talk a little bit about what that process would be like of figuring out what that angle is? Or does that something that just comes to you?
don't know. You know, you got to let it sit up a little bit. It kind of just comes to you, though. You know, it's the old thing. They say tragedy plus time is comedy. Like, you probably couldn't tell a joke about it yesterday. And by the way, the joke's never going to be about, you know, Eric. The joke would be about just the hypocrisy. What did I write the other day? It's like, are black men an endangered species? No, because endangered species are protected by the law. Yeah, I mean, that's an example of people, you can't cross the line. There is no line. It's just like, can you write the joke or can you not write the joke?
When you were growing up, your father had grown up in a different world. It was a different era.
Right.
And I don't know how distant his era felt from you when you were young. Because I know, like, my parents' childhood felt like way far away to me when I was growing up. And now history just seems much more compressed to me. The past seems much more present to me now as an adult than it did to me as a child. The past seemed very remote, irrelevant in a lot of ways. And I guess in raising your daughters, knowing that they're growing up in such a kind of different world than you did, both because times have changed and because you're so successful, they're growing up the children of a very successful, famous person. Do you worry that your world, the world you grew up in, will seem so far away and remote to them? And what are some of the things you feel you can do to make sure it doesn't feel that way?
My world is far and remote to them. I don't know if it's a good thing that they feel the way I felt about something. They're in another world. I try to, you know, tell them there is racism out there. I don't want them to be shocked by it. But at the same time, they shouldn't be as paranoid as I am because, you know, their circumstances are just so much different. I think my father's world was much closer to mine because we pretty much grew up the same way. My father and mother were able to give us a slightly better life than they had, but because of success, you're right. It's not only the times, but just because of money, it's almost like I've been able to take my kids into a time machine and go to another planet almost. But there's still stuff happening in that planet. My kids, you know, they travel the world. They go to Africa. They do volunteer work in Brooklyn. They know what's going on, but they're never going to know like a poor kid knows. You know, we'll see. I think I'm doing a good job, but until life punches one of them in the face, we'll see what they're made of. Life punched me in the face pretty early, and my kids are probably not going to get punched for another 10 years. So we'll see. We'll see if they had a better childhood than me or not.
Chris Rock wrote, directed, and stars in the new film Top 5. You'll find a longer version of his conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, has chosen his word of the year. Actually, it's a phrase, and it comes from the unsettling feeling we have these days that online or off, our moves are being tracked in ways we aren't aware of.
Infobesity, lumbersexual, phablet. As usual, the items that stand out as candidates for Word of the Year are like its biggest pop songs, catchy but ephemeral. But even a fleeting expression can sometimes encapsulate the zeitgeist. That's why I'm nominating Godview for the honor. It's the term the car company Uber uses for a map view that shows them the locations of all the Uber cars in an area and silhouettes of the people who ordered them. The media seized on the term this fall when it came out that the company had been entertaining themselves and their guests by pairing that view with their customer data so they could display the movements of journalists and VIP customers as they made their way around New York. Those reports came on top of earlier criticisms of Uber for taking a prurient interest in its customers' movements. Not long before, an Uber data scientist had blogged about tracking what he called rides of glory. Those were the customers who booked rides late on weekend nights and then returned home a few hours later, presumably after one-night stands. You could think of that as the Uber Santa view. He doesn't just know when you've been sleeping, but where. Those were awkward revelations for Uber, which has also been under fire for its sharp-elbowed tactics with regulators and competitors and a truculent attitude toward its critics. The so-called sharing economy depends on users providing a company with enough personal information to reassure others that they're okay to rent to or drive around with. As Airbnb put it last year, when they asked users to provide their Facebook contacts and pictures of their driver's licenses, there's no place for anonymity in a trusted community. So it doesn't look good when the people entrusted with the information come off as a crew of brash striplings who seem to take privacy casually. Calling the display God View didn't help dispel that impression, particularly coming from a company whose name already suggested a certain Teutonic grandiosity. But if Uber's choice of words was ill-advised, it's still a pretty apt name for the way technology sees us now. Every week brings another indication that the world is becoming a vast panopticon, a place where everybody can be observed without being aware of it. An app displays the Facebook profile of every woman in the immediate vicinity who's logged in on Foursquare. A website streams live video from thousands of unsecured webcams along with their map locations. And we're dogged by those uncannily personalized ads as we browse the web. In a course I co-teach at Berkeley, we ask our students to try to figure out what Google knows about them. One young woman tried switching to a new browser and entering searches for products like Stride-Rite shoes and Barry Manilow albums. She wasn't surprised when ads for menopause supplements started to appear on the web pages she visited, but it was unsettling when her boyfriend started seeing ads for Viagra. What we're talking about here, of course, is the sense that the world is getting more and more creepy. That word has been around too long to be a candidate for Word of the Year, but it's clearly in the running for Word of the Era. It goes back to the time of Dickens, but we use it more often and more broadly than ever before. It's our aesthetic reaction to everything from John Malkovich to Furbies. And it's become our reflexive response to the unnerving promiscuity of digital information. Scholars ponder it. You see articles in academic journals and law reviews with titles like A Theory of Creepiness and Leakiness and Creepiness in App Space. As the thinking goes, understand creepiness and you've located the boundaries of personal privacy, the line you mustn't trespass. Creepy's a more elusive notion than scary. Scary things are the ones that set our imagination to racing with dire scenarios of cyber stalkers, identity thieves, or government surveillance. Whereas with creepy things, our imagination doesn't really know where to start. There doesn't have to be any concrete threat we can point to. There's only the unease we feel when we realize we've been the object of somebody's unbidden gaze. A while ago, my wife was caught by Google Street View early one morning as she was opening our gate after taking out the garbage. It creeped her out. "You can see me from Buenos Aires," she said, "and I wouldn't even wear those pants to the Safeway." Not that most of the builders of the technology are actively trying to creep us out, though they're willing to come close. As Google's Eric Schmidt said, Google policy is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it. But that line is constantly moving as we get more and more used to being exposed. Time was when we'd be creeped out if somebody Googled us before a meeting or a first date. Now we're fine with that, and even post profiles to make it easier. Follow that logic, some people say, and the creepiness of technology may come to seem a passing phase. But this isn't really about technology in the first place. What we find creepy isn't those God views in themselves, but the people we fear might be out there using them. There may be no more creeps in the world than in earlier times, but there have never been so many opportunities for acting like one.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the University of California, Berkeley School of Information. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's interview with author Jacqueline Woodson. I'll let Terry introduce it.
Although my guest Jacqueline Woodson won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature last month for her memoir in verse, Brown Girl Dreaming, it was a very good read for me as an adult. It's about growing up in the 60s and 70s, in the segregated South and in Brooklyn. Woodson won a Coretta Scott King Book Award for her young adult book, Miracles Boys, which is narrated by a 12-year-old whose brother comes home from a juvenile detention center where he spent time for armed robbery. Woodson's book, From the Notebooks of Melanin Sun, is about an African-American boy whose mother falls in love with a white woman. Her picture book, Show Way, was inspired by her own family history and is about how quilts served as secret maps for freedom-seeking slaves. The Woodson family traces its family tree back to Thomas Jefferson's slave mistress, Sally Hemings. Jacqueline Woodson, welcome to Fresh Air, and congratulations. So I'd like you to read the opening poem from Brown Girl Dreaming.
February 12, 1963. I am born on a Tuesday at University Hospital, Columbus, Ohio, USA, a country caught between black and white. I am born not long from the time or far from the place where my great-great-grandparents worked the deep, rich land, unfree, dawn till dusk, unpaid, drank cool water from scooped-out gourds, looked up and followed the sky's mirrored constellation to freedom. I am born as the South explodes, too many people, too many years, enslaved, then emancipated, but not free. The people who look like me keep fighting and marching and getting killed so that today, February 12, 1963, and every day from this moment on, brown children like me can grow up free, can grow up learning and voting and walking and riding wherever we want. I am born in Ohio, but the stories of South Carolina already run like rivers through my veins.
So, you know, your memoir is written in verse, and some people might think, oh, poetry, like, that's going to make it harder. They might think that's a little off-putting. It's actually, I think, easier to read than it would have been in prose in the sense that it's so not dense. There's so much space around the words. it's so easy mm-hmm. to read.
Yeah, I mean, that was my intention. It's a book of memories, and it's how memory comes to us. It comes in these small moments with all of this white space around it. And I think that that's what you get in reading it. You get that small moment, and that moment, I'm hoping, is very, very clear on the page. And then the moments are, of course, linked together to tell the story.
The North and the South are like characters in your book. You're born in Ohio. Your mother's from Greenville, South Carolina, where your maternal grandparents still lived when you were born. When your parents separated when you were very young, you, your mother, and your siblings moved to South Carolina to be with your grandparents. But then later, as a girl, you moved to be with your mother in Brooklyn. When you moved to the South, to Greenville, when you were, what, 1 year old?
I was probably a little bit. I was an infant.
Oh, okay.
So I wasn't yet walking.
So there's another poem I want you to read, and this one is called Journey, and it's about how, you know, we were talking about how the North and the South are like characters in your book, and that you grew up in both places. And apparently this was a conflict between your parents before they separated. Your mother, you know, wanted to live in the South. Your father did not. He was from the North. He was from Ohio. And that's what this poem is about. Would you read it for us?
Sure. Journey. You can keep your South, my father says. The way they treated us down there, I got your mama out as quick as I could. Brought her right up here to Ohio. Told her there was never going to be a Woodson that sits in the back of the bus. Never going to be a Woodson that has to yes sir and no sir white people. Never going to be a Woodson made to look down at the ground. All you kids are stronger than that, my father says. All you Woodson kids deserve to be as good as you already are. Yes, sirree, Bob, my father says. You can keep your South Carolina.
When you were growing up, were you aware that that was like a point of argument between your parents?
Not at all. I wasn't until I was much older, I would say around 7 or 8. And I think what I knew was they were both fiercely attached to their families. And my father's family was in Ohio, and my mother's family was in South Carolina. And then later on, I realized they were also fiercely attached to place and what they had always known. So it was interesting just investigating those two worlds and coming to understand what would pull people apart.
Now, as an adult who's lived in the North and in the South, do you see both sides of that dispute?
I completely see both sides of that dispute. I think there is such richness to the South and a lushness and a way of life. I could never live it full time. You know, I feel like I'm a New Yorker to the bone, but there is a lot of the South in me. I know there is a lot of the South in my mannerisms. There's a lot of the South in my expectations of other people and how people treat each other. There's a lot of the South in the way I speak, but it can never be home.
Why not?
Well, aside from the fact that I'm so fiercely attached to New York and my life here, I think, you know, given the fact that I have a partner and we have a multiracial family, and I think it wouldn't be a safe place for my kids. I don't want my kids to have to walk through a world where they have to constantly explain who they are and who their family is.
What are some of the differences the North and the South brought out in you and your personality and how you talked and behaved?
Well, one of the differences is I still say hi to strangers, but in New York, strangers don't say hi back, and my daughter is mortified by it. You know, the whole idea that I would say good morning to someone, and it's just so ingrained in who I am. I think it also, there is this way in which I'm not afraid of silence. You know, I'm not afraid to sit in a room and have the conversation drop into silence. I think that's a very Southern thing, and I write about that in the book. You know, when the heat is enough to melt the mouth, so Southern folks knew to stay silent. And I think sometimes we're afraid of that silence. We're afraid of what it implies or what people are thinking. But I do feel like that's a cultural thing that I learned in South Carolina. I think in terms of being a New Yorker, as my friends would say, I don't take a lot of mess. Like I have no tolerance for people who are not thinking deeply about things. I have no tolerance for the kind of small talk that people need to fill silence. And I have no tolerance for people not being a part of the world and being in it and trying to change it.
While you were living with your grandparents in Greenville, South Carolina, your mother left for a while to go up north and eventually found a place to bring you and your siblings back to in the north. While you were living with your grandparents, it was understood that you would take your grandmother's religion, and she was a Jehovah's Witness. And so before we talk about that period of your life, I'd like you to read the poem in your memoir called Faith.
After my mother leaves, my grandmother pulls us further into the religion she has always known. We become Jehovah's Witnesses, like her. After my mother leaves, there is no one to say. The children can choose their own faith when they're old enough. In my house, my grandmother says, you will do as I do. After my mother leaves, we wake in the middle of the night calling out for her. Have faith, my grandmother says, pulling us to her in the darkness. Let the Bible, my grandmother says, become your sword and your shield. But we do not know yet who we are fighting and what we are fighting for.
How did your mother feel about you becoming a Jehovah's Witness, was she?
My mother was as a child, and she believed in the faith, but she didn't necessarily practice it. So as we were growing up, she basically sent us to the Kingdom Hall, and she'd go once in a while, but she definitely believed in the actual faith of being a Jehovah's Witness.
Is the Kingdom Hall the church? Meeting place?
So, yes, the Kingdom Hall is the meeting place.
So your grandfather didn't believe. What are the basic beliefs of Jehovah's Witnesses?
Well, one of the main beliefs is that we are in the world, but not of the world. And it served me well as both a young person and an adult. And they believe that because we are not actually a part of the world, because we're considered God's chosen people, that we shouldn't behave as worldly people do. So we don't celebrate holidays. We don't celebrate birthdays. We believe that this system of things is going to end and there will be a better system of things, a new world. And those witnesses who've died will be resurrected in that new world, and that this system will end with Armageddon, and that the signs of Armageddon are constantly upon us. So the Bible is big in the religion. treating people as you want to be treated. I think there is, it's Christian, so it's a lot of the Christian principles.
But you don't celebrate Christmas?
No. Yeah, I guess Christmas is Christian, huh? no holidays. So it's a Christian sect, so there are Christians, but Jehovah's Witnesses consider themselves different from those Christians.
So something you don't write about in the memoir is coming to the understanding that you are a lesbian. How old were you when you knew that?
You know, I probably, the first mirror I had, Maria had an aunt, Alma, and we loved Alma. And Alma...
Maria was your good friend.
Maria's my best friend, yeah, and she and I are still really close. And Alma was this kind of beautiful, very butch woman who always had these beautiful, very femme girlfriends. And I definitely, you know, saw something there, but I knew I wasn't Alma. I knew I wasn't, you know, I knew I didn't have this interest in wearing man's clothes and having this huge, I did want the afro, actually. And I knew I wasn't her girlfriends, who are these really high femmes, but I knew there was something there that struck a chord in me. And it wasn't like now where you can name stuff, you know. I think when I got into college and my housemate Beth said to me, you know, I'm gay, and I'm like, oh, me too. Like, suddenly a light went on, and I thought, this is what it is. But I always had boyfriends as a, you know, young person and as a teenager, many of whom are really still close, we're close. But I didn't have the language for what I was discovering yet. And I think, obviously, if I had grown up in this time, I probably would have been out by the time I was 12 years old. I mean, the closest I came to it as a kid was being called a tomboy because I was kind of rough and tumble, but I also still wore ribbons.
So coming from, like, having been raised in the tradition of Jehovah's Witnesses, where there's so much you mm-hmm. weren't allowed to do, how did being gay fit into that or not?
Yeah, it wasn't even, I remember my mother would get upset with me because she said I walked like my dad. And I always thought she was getting upset with me because it reminded her of someone she wasn't too happy with. But I think it was more like, there's something about you that's not quite ladylike and femme. And then when I got older, once I came out, I mean, my mom and grandma were horrified and just kind of like, where did we go wrong? And they actually blamed it on my sorority, which is ridiculous. So, but I think it took them many, many years to kind of realize that this is who I was. But at the same time, you know, one of the things about being a witness is you're kind of not supposed to associate with people who are not a part of the truth, who are not witnesses. And if your family members do something and they're witnesses, then they get kind of excommunicated. They call it disfellowshipped. But I think that was the point where my grandmother and mother, although they still believed a lot in the truth, they were not going to disown their family. You know, the family was just so much tighter than having to make that kind of choice was just not an option. But they were not happy at all.
And how old were you when they found out?
When they found out, I was probably around 19 or 20. But mm-hmm. when I found out, I was probably around 18.
Okay. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jacqueline Woodson, and she won the National Book Award in November in the category of Young People's Literature for her memoir in verse called Brown Girl Dreaming. So your name is Jacqueline Woodson, and so your father's side of the family, the Woodson side of the family, is believed to be or believe themselves to be descendants of Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. And Sally Hemings was the person who was his slave and his mistress. And, you know, coincidentally, as right before I read your book, I was paging through a book about genealogy that said that, you know, that actually the Woodson family is descended from Sally Hemings, but the father in that line wasn't Jefferson, it was somebody else. So what do you know from your aunt, who's a specialist in genealogy, what do you know about the Sally Hemings story?
The story that we've been told is that the first son that was born on the plantation to Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson looked so much like Thomas Jefferson and had red hair and very, very pale, and was sent to the Woodson Plantation and just gotten off the land. And that's where the blip in the history comes in. And it's so interesting because I wasn't there, but this has always been our story. And my Aunt Ada talks about how, you know, there's this huge Woodson reunion that happens in Ohio. And then I think something else happens. But anyway, so this is what I've always known to be the connection to Thomas Woodson and Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And his name was actually Thomas Woodson.
So whether Jefferson was actually the father or not, it seems pretty sure from my understanding that Sally Hemings was the mother. When the Sally Hemings story started getting to be an official part of history, how did you feel about that, knowing that the story that had been passed on in your family was now like a kind of certified historical story, or at least part of it was?
You know, it's interesting because I think whether or not it would have been certified, I would have still believed in and celebrated it because it's what I've always known. And then to have that, have the kind of world say, yep, this is true. I don't know how much that matters to me that the rest of the world now cares, because it's about us, it's about our family and what we know and what we need to know to understand our own history. So it doesn't feel like it now it's legitimized, because the question is, who does it need to be legitimized for? And for me, it just needs to feel right to me.
Jacqueline Woodson won the National Book Award for Young People's Literature last month for her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry Gross online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inkulu.